From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, in 2014, an algal bloom tainted the drinking water in Toledo. Now there are new blooms on Lake Erie and the Maumee River.
The bloom that's occurring in the Maumee River is not necessarily tied into Toledo's drinking water, but the bloom in Lake Erie certainly is, as we found out in 2014.
Who gets to define campus sexual assault?
We know that a lot of sexual assaults on campus involve alcohol, but that does not mean that consent was given.
Here's an idea for Amazon's second headquarters. Ditch the big campus for neighborhood work centers.
And I really think that a megaplex kind of isolates a company and a culture, and that's not where innovation is taking place.
And music from gifts or creatures.
We tend to use the phrase quirky folk music or storytelling.
Those stories and much more for you today on Stateside. Hello and welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. This hour,
one rape is one too many. One assault is one too many. One person denied due process is one too many.
We continue exploring the recent decision by Education Secretary Betsy DeVos to rescind Obama-era guidance on campus sexual assault. But first, an algal bloom is once again bedeviling western Lake Erie and Ohio's Maumee River. And even though water scientists say toxin levels are among the lowest they've seen all season and the treated Lake Erie water is safe to drink, people in Toledo have their doubts. With us now is Toledo Mayor Paula Hicks Hudson. Mayor, how would you describe the way Toledo residents have been reacting to the green Maumee River?
Well, I believe that they are reacting, unfortunately, with overabundance of caution because the condition and the color of the river water is green. The water each and every day at the tap is safe to drink, and that, in fact, we get our drinking water from Lake Erie. We don't get it from the river. And since I've been mayor 2015, we've had no problems with drinking the water.
What are you hearing that makes you be able to say to people in Toledo, it is safe?
Well, it's not what I hear. It's what I know for a fact. Since becoming mayor, I not only went out to the middle of Lake Erie to see where our water is drawn in, but I have been intimately involved with our scientists and our chemists who each and every day draw from the lake, test the water. There are a number of early detection signs that are in Lake Erie that we are able to adjust the treatment of water based upon the pH factors or whatever's happening, the blue algae composition. There's a number of different factors that these signs are testing that we, at the not me personally, but the scientists and all of the technicians that are certified under the various licenses, test the water, changes the way that we treat it so that at the tap it is safe to drink. We instituted a dashboard that is based upon the rules from the U.S. and Ohio EPA that depending upon the amount of toxins, now the toxic algae, those that are in the lake water, we move our dashboard from clear to watch or warning or whatever based upon the testing that we do, and we have a protocol that we follow each and every day during the half season so that I know that the water is safe to drink. In fact, I'm drinking some water right now as we speak that comes from the tap, not from bottles.
Why do you think it's been tough to get some residents to believe you?
Well, I think it's because of the, unfortunately, we live in a world now where instant news may not be really news, but rumors. You know, we're fighting rumors, which is unfortunately a part of what, you know, we deal with now under, you know, these different types of sources of information, I'll call them.
Do you think that perhaps people in Toledo saw what happened in Flint in 2014 and 2015? The mayor of Flint drank water from the tap. They did a toast, you know, when they flipped the water over to the Flint River. And I'm not saying that this situation is the same, but people saw that. And people in Flint were told by authorities, it's good, don't worry. And as it turned out, it wasn't.
Right.
Do you think that has colored people's thinking?
That's part of it. I don't discount and I don't dismiss the fear that people have, because that fear is how humans have been able to survive, by acting on that fear. And that's really what happened not only here in Toledo in 2014 with our Do Not Drink Advisory, but also what's happened in Flint, and there's other parts of our country where, you know, you hear stories about don't drink the water because there's been some type of problem either with processing or pollution or what have you. So all of those stories, I think, coming to the forefront is causing people to have some fear, and I understand it.
Mayor, this week you changed course and you announced that you are supporting a request to federally designate Lake Erie's Western Basin as impaired. What would this designation mean?
It's a request for the designation. The designation has to come from the state and from the federal government. And there is a belief that with that will come additional dollars and resources to help us deal with this issue.
In a nutshell, when you think of long-term solutions, Mayor, what has frustrated you most about the process of coming up with a lasting fix to this problem of algal blooms?
We're not there yet. I think that's the thing that frustrates me the most, because it's going to take a long time for us to find and to fashion the solution and the remedy, because it's not a single bullet. The Maumee River starts in Indiana, and the watershed includes Michigan, Indiana, and Ohio. Lake Erie borders on Canada, so that brings in the international jurisdiction that also has an impact on the lake. Some of our eating habits causes the problem, because we are asking for more and more meat. So we have these industrial farms that are not properly processing the manure. The climate change, we have issues with climate change where, for us, the reason that we had this bloom going into the river was because there was no wind to push it out. And, you know, the temperature was so hot here. So when you look at all these different factors that come into play, we have to stop and bring everybody to the table. You know, I have asked, and I will continue to ask, that the president issue an executive order being able to have all of the different parts of the federal government, the Department of Agriculture, the U.S. EPA Department, NOAA, and bring all of the scientists together so we can say, this is the standard, this is the level that we have to achieve and provide incentives, restrictions, or what have you, so that we can get to that point where we're not dumping, you know, phosphorus into the watershed. You know, I don't believe that we need to point fingers anymore. We need to come around the table and come up with solutions to solve this. That's my frustration.
Toledo Mayor Paula Hicks Hudson, thanks so much for speaking with us, Mayor.
Thank you.
Now we turn to Tim Davis. He's an associate professor in the Department of Biological Sciences at Bowling Green State University. Real quickly, Tim, everyone calls this an algal bloom. We did some stories here at Michigan Radio about cyanobacteria producing the toxins that lead to this green stuff that people are worried about. How do you, as a scientist, talk about this bloom on Lake Erie?
So we do refer to it as a harmful algal bloom, because harmful algal bloom is a broad term used to describe these events in marine through freshwater systems. So even though cyanobacteria are not true algae, we consider this to be a harmful algal bloom because it gets lumped into the category of harmful algal blooms that we use across the marine freshwater continuum.
So it looks like St. Patrick's Day, the way they dye the Chicago River green. Well, it looks like that on the Maumee River running through Toledo. What happened over the last few days to turn the river green?
So there are a few things that led to the bloom that we're currently seeing on the Maumee River. Now, the Maumee River typically does have cyanobacteria in it throughout the summer. One of the reasons why we typically don't see this type of a buildup is that rivers generally flow. So as the Maumee River flows out into Lake Erie, it moves that water, so you never really see this buildup. But basically what's happened is that we haven't had a whole lot of rain, and of course there has been this record-setting heat wave that's come through. So we have a river that's pretty much turned into a lake because it's no longer flowing very quickly. It has a very low flow rate, and it's really warm and high in nutrients. Those three components together lead to what we're seeing now, which is this large algal bloom.
And do people in Toledo need to worry about their drinking water?
I would say at this point, no, because the Toledo water intake is actually out in the western basin of Lake Erie. The bloom that's occurring in the Maumee River is not necessarily tied into Toledo's drinking water, but the bloom in Lake Erie certainly is, as we found out in 2014.
In fact, let's talk about that. How does this bloom, this algal bloom, compare to that big one that caused Toledo to have its water supply shut off?
Well, that's a really interesting question. The 2014 bloom was not a record-setting bloom. The blooms in 2011 and 2015 were much larger. What happened in 2014 is that there was a bloom event that was occurring in Maumee Bay that got flushed east towards the intake.
What does the bloom look like around the drinking water intake right now?
Right now, the bulk of the bloom seems to be kind of spreading out through the center of the Western Basin and is actually really impacting the North Shore, the Ontario Shore, a lot more than it is around the intake. That doesn't mean there isn't any biomass around the intake, but if you look at the NOAA bloom forecast, what it's showing is by October 1st, that bloom is going to move into the region of the Toledo water intake. So we're not out of the woods yet. The bloom is still going. There are toxins still present. I want to qualify that by saying that these blooms have been occurring for 15 years on Lake Erie, and we've only had a few instances where toxins have been detected in finished drinking water. So for the most part, our drinking water treatment plants are doing a very good job at eliminating and significantly reducing the toxins before they exit the plant.
I understand bloom toxicity is usually lower in September than it is in late July or early August. Just how toxic is this current bloom in Lake Erie?
At the eight sites that NOAA monitors, microcystins, the toxins are all below one part per billion. And just as a guideline, the state of Ohio has a 1.6 part per billion threshold for their drinking water advisory. Basically, the overall bloom toxicity is lower, so size doesn't always mean more toxic. Although scums, the toxicity in those surface scums that make the water look green like paint, can still be very high, and those areas should be avoided.
What's it going to take to clear this water up? Do we need to see temperatures drop?
So on a seasonal basis, yes. These blooms typically last from mid-July through the end of October. So this is not atypical to see a bloom in Lake Erie this time of year. As the water continues to cool, these cyanobacteria don't grow very well in water that's below 15 degrees centigrade, so it will continue to dissipate. On a much larger focus, what do we need to do to clean up Lake Erie? We need to control the amount of nitrogen and phosphorus coming off our lands into the lake, and that's a lot easier said than done.
Bottom line, last few seconds, what precautions, if any, do you suggest people in that corner of Ohio take?
Keep tabs on the news, but also just recreationally, avoid these. If you see water that's green, avoid it. Don't let your pets in it. Don't let your kids swim in it. I would say that folks should feel pretty confident that their water is safe and know that the drinking water treatment plants are doing a good job of removing toxins, but it's always good to be prepared.
Tim Davis, water scientist at Bowling Green State University. Tim, thanks for your time.
Thank you for having me.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty.
Creation.
Entrepreneurship.
The next idea.
We have to make room for this ability to learn to be creative.
From sea to shining sea, American cities are in a hot competition. They're trying to win the prize of being the location of Amazon's second headquarters. The online retail giant, as we know, is asking cities for proposals, tax breaks, incentives. Show us what you've got, and it's all due by mid-October. Our latest contributor to The Next Idea is taking a different tack. He wrote a direct letter to Amazon founder Jeff Bezos to convince him to give Detroit a shot at the new headquarters. Transportation engineer Ethan Eagle is an assistant professor of mechanical engineering at Wayne State University. With us now, welcome to The Next Idea, Ethan.
Thanks, Cynthia. It's great to be here.
Why'd you want to write to Jeff?
Goodness. Last week, there was a Detroit Economic Club Young Leaders meeting, and in that meeting, we heard from people from around the city and around the region just about how vibrant the city of Detroit really is. And I was just captivated by that meeting and really inspired. I woke up the next morning at like 3 a.m. and just started thinking about what opportunity there was in Detroit and how much untapped potential I really believe that there was in the city. And I wanted to write about my expertise in transportation and kind of propose something to Jeff that was a little bit different than his vision or that the vision that Amazon has articulated. Because I think it's not the future. I think we have a 19th or 20th century idea that we have to bring people to these centers of work.
These big campuses.
A big megaplex, right? And I think instead it's way more efficient, as somebody who cares about the environment and sustainability. Let's move centers of work out to the people. And so this is what I talk about in the piece.
Yeah, so you talk about Amazon connecting Detroit and its suburbs with a number of smaller work areas and not focus on that mega complex like we've seen with Google and Facebook and Apple. So what do you think that would accomplish?
I really think, and in my expertise goes beyond transportation. I actually do innovation coaching, and I've been working in innovation for the last 6 years. And when we see innovation taking place, we don't see it in cultural centers where everybody is isolated. We see it in these melting pots and these mixing grounds where you bring a lot of different ideas together. And I really think that a megaplex kind of isolates a company and our culture, and that's not where innovation is taking place. Amazon's known for being an innovative company. If they want to drive innovation, I think they need to get away from this idea of a big corporate headquarters and start going out into neighborhoods.
So break it down. What would it look like if you could wave your wand and get Amazon to follow your suggestion? What would it look like?
Well, that's actually a brilliant suggestion, right? So I do a lot of idealized redesign. So we say, let's start with a blank sheet of paper. What would a city look like if we started with the idea that we could have digital infrastructure, not roads? You know, let's build information superhighways. We can move data so much faster than we can move people. I mean, data moves at the speed of light. We had this mobility roundtable in Detroit a couple weeks ago, and people said, you know, what would be the ideal transportation speed? And people, obviously, like, let's teleport. But you can already do that. If I pull up a Google Hangout, I can talk to somebody around the world at the speed of light. Why am I stuck in this idea that I have to get in a car and drive from Detroit to Ann Arbor for this interview?
Yes.
Right? Instead of embracing this digital change. We didn't have that technology 50, 100 years ago, but we have it now. And so if we re-envision a city from a blank sheet of paper, what would we get to?
So this would, the technology is there to make it happen. So what are you seeing? A lot of small Amazon offices sprinkled around Southeast Michigan?
I think what I've seen is the brilliance of these co-working spaces. And so you allow these people from different industries to kind of come together. Really, the ideal size of a workspace is something kind of like a community. By the time you get more than like 100 or 200 employees at a site, it starts to feel like you're institutionalized and you're maybe just a number and people don't know your name or recognize you. And that's not good for corporate culture. So if you want to encourage people to really embrace ownership of their jobs and their function and not just feel like, hey, I'm just doing this for my job, it's just my 9-to-5. If you want to engage your employees in your workforce, you need to create these little communities for them. So yes, let's spread out instead of 50,000 employees in one site, let's spread that around the city of Detroit.
And what makes Detroit good for that? And would you also include the suburbs in this plan?
Absolutely. So I mean, why Detroit? I think, you know, I did a little research on Jeff prior to writing this piece, and Amazon's was almost called Relentless. And actually the web domain relentless.com redirects to Amazon. And I think that the city of Detroit really embodies that word. I mean, Detroit is relentless. It is a city that I don't think is revitalizing. I think it has always been moving forward. And I've watched and been a student and I've been trying to study the sort of the history of Detroit. And to me, it seems like Detroit has always been moving forward. It's not that Detroit is going to come back or that Amazon will help Detroit come back. It's that I think Detroit could help Amazon move forward. And so I think Amazon should embrace kind of the wave of enthusiasm and belief in Detroit that's happening right now. They could ride that wave, ride that momentum, and really do something powerful and different, be innovative, not just a technology innovation that they're kind of known for, but really a social innovation.
Now, you are an engineer by trade with a focus on mobility technology, but here this vision that you're spelling out for an Amazon headquarters would be less commuting, less traffic, more neighborhood workspaces. Do you see these two things as being at odds?
Not at all. So, you know, I, for the last 10 years, have lived and worked close together. I lived in Ann Arbor and rode the bus and walked to work. I moved to California for 3 years, mm-hmm. and I rode my bike every day. And I finally came back to Detroit, and for the first 6 months, I walked to work. I walked to Wayne State. I lived in Detroit, and I walked around. And it was a great experience of the city. People are sort of engrossed by this vision of an autonomous future. And let me tell you, Cynthia, I am an autonomous vehicle when I walk to work. I can be on my phone. I can call. My mind can wander. Maybe when I'm crossing the road, that's the only time I really need to have situational awareness. But people are sort of dreaming of this future that's already available to them if they just could live close to where they worked. Now, I see transportation and you watch commercials for vehicles and nobody's commuting in those commercials. They're always out doing something joyful. And I think that transportation provides that joy and should provide that joy. That's really the value of having your vehicle, is that you can go to family and visit these beautiful places around Michigan, right? But a commute to work is not the purpose of a vehicle.
Well, I'll second that as somebody who has an hour and a half each way to get to work. Well, fascinating idea. You can find Ethan's essay by going to the Next Idea page at michiganradio.org. Ethan Eagle, thank you so much for sharing your innovative idea with us.
It's a great pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Support for the Next Idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.
Finding inspiration for writing and making music can be a challenge for songwriters. But for Brandon and Bethany Foote, inspiration is all around them. The duo known as Gifts or Creatures is out with its third full-length album. It's titled Fair Mitten, New Songs of the Historic Great Lakes Basin. Their music celebrates the rich history and beauty of the Upper Midwest. Stateside producer Mercedes Mejia spoke with Brandon and Bethany about writing music inspired by this place they call home.
Bethany and Brandon, welcome back to Stateside.
It's an honor to be here. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
It's been a while since you last joined us. I think it was back in 2013 you were out with your album Yesteryear, Western Darkness. How do you two describe your music?
Well, we get that question a lot, and I think we tend to use the phrase quirky folk music or storytelling. It's hard to nail down, I guess, the specifics, but that gives you a little bit of a general picture of the type of music that we play and the messages that we tend to give across through that music.
You know, it has this lyrical quality that it's more prose than direct. It definitely has a sense that it's not exactly these heavy stories that you're jumping into and maybe fully understanding right away, but I think that you develop a relationship with them over time.
I think there's an element of piquing someone's interest without it being super literal, and it's not really a one-answer-fits-all type thing.
Well, let's take a listen to the song Two Hearts, Two Peninsulas.
Two hearts.
Really exploring with this song and with some of the other songs on this album?
This song is definitely a celebratory piece. It's just kind of really looks at the beautiful rivers, the waterways of Michigan, and the two peninsulas and the unique geographic, you know, makeup of our state. Much of the rest of the record digs a little bit deeper into the history of the state and the region of the Great Lakes Basin in general. It's heavily Michigan-influenced, having grown up here and lived here my whole life. But I think that there's a lot to learn from the past, and there's a lot that we don't know about the past. And in doing so, you learn more about yourself and where you came from and what's come before you and who lived here before you. And even the landscapes, how they've changed over time, and definitely makes you feel a little more connected to the area at the end of the day.
If you just look at the song titles, you have Pontiac's Rebellion, Fort Dearborn, Trout of the Pines, Manitou Peninsula. How do you kind of dig into some of these? What are the creative process or creative challenges that you encounter when you're making music?
I spent some time at the Archives of Michigan at the Michigan History Center in Lansing. The state archivist, Mark Harvey, was really, he's behind me all the way on this project, and it was really nice to have somebody that wasn't necessarily a musician, but a lover of history and the importance of kind of preserving the history of our state, somebody that really was able to just look at me and say, hey, this is a cool idea. What can I help you with, and what do you want to do with it? And that kind of springboarded me into looking at the places I've been. You know, the Manitou Islands are a place that I love, and this tune Manitou Passage came about, that inland sea passage in Lake Michigan. The Trout of the Pines was inspired by a map that we had hanging on our wall that had a watermark of the Arctic grayling on it. And the Arctic grayling is a fish that once swam the waters of Michigan, and it's no longer found here.
Did you feed on gold?
I just started asking questions of what was life like before we lived here? And what was life like for the native peoples of this area before European settlers came? And then I also look at the struggle that happened between the European settlers and the natives. You know, Pontiac's Rebellion is exactly looking right at that, and that difficulty of just imperialism and that battle of what's right and what's wrong at the end of the day.
When tribes came to be, the mighty Mississippi, the mitten seized the call on that dark and bloody day. The fort was meant to stay. My heart.
Touched on it a little bit, but what is it about making music in Michigan that you think is special, Bethany?
Well, I think Brandon and I both feel really fondly about this state. We both have roots here. I have so many positive memories of going over to Lake Michigan, driving over from Lansing, from, you know, the middle of the mitten, and spending time on the sand dunes and in the water with my family and with friends. Both Brandon and I have pretty magical memories of exploring the woods near our home or in the northern woods, and just the imagination that goes along with that. I'm an early childhood educator, and I think part of that influences the way that I see music and the way that I see this project and how we kind of cast vision for the next generation and think about what is it that we're leaving for the children, and what is the state going to look like for our son and for his friends and even for his children. So there's a little bit of those kind of themes tied in as well. But overall, there's just such a strong community here in Michigan. We are really blessed to be a part of it. We feel a huge sense of encouragement and camaraderie from fellow musicians here in Michigan. And I think there's a sense of pride and ownership that comes with people from Michigan that's maybe unique to this state. And we certainly feel that pride and love to share some of that magic with other people about this place that's sometimes off the beaten path and maybe not visited by others as much as it maybe should be.
Well, Bethany, Brandon, thanks so much for talking with us on Stateside.
Thanks, Mercedes.
Thank you so much.
Army of the Northwest for Dearborn Massacre. Torched in quarter hour, the loop, the loop. Cold, windy city, Michigan shore be still.
Gifts or Creatures has a CD release show in Lansing at the Robin Theater tomorrow, September 29th, and a show in Kalamazoo, October 21st, and they'll be in Grand Rapids on November 4th. All the details can be found on their website, giftsorcreatures.com. Support for arts and culture coverage comes in part from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio.
Southward we ride, Michigan shore be still. Wells your heart, you valor.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. The FBI calls it a scheme involving bribery, corruption, and fraud. That's what federal investigators had to say about the alleged bribery scheme uncovered by their investigation into men's college basketball. Michigan Radio sports commentator John U. Bacon is here now. In a nutshell, John, we're talking about a lot of money and not for the student athletes?
No, it is getting to them also. Kickbacks as well as for the coaches. Money sloshing all around is the answer to this one.
And when you think about the most visible casualty, Rick Pitino, and having the University of Louisville dead center, which I can tell by your face, no surprise for you.
No surprise, and not a lot of sympathy either. I spent a week with the guy in 95, and I liked him a lot. Very impressed by him as a coach. He's a hell of a coach, and it can be a nice, charming guy. However, when you are claiming, he used in a press release the word shocked, that he's shocked by these allegations. Don't make it that easy for us, for crying out loud. Shocked by gambling at in Casablanca, of course. So, no, he was dead to rights. We were all waiting for this to happen. And here's the key point. The NCAA has found nothing. And the FBI is the one that did the investigation. Now, they've got bigger things to worry about these days than just this, which shows you how appalled they are at the NCAA's complete fecklessness, that they have got to do your job for you and doing it far better, of course. And NCAA President Mark Emmert came out and said, I had no idea about this until today. He thinks he's covering his backside. What you are is exposing yourself as both willfully incompetent and the fact the FBI clearly did not see the NCAA as a partner in pursuing this, but in fact, the problem.
Well, how rampant is this in men's basketball? I think a lot of people are asking, what about our coaches here in the state of Michigan?
I'm glad you asked, because I have good news there, citizens of Michigan and fans of the Spartans and the Wolverines. 1 month ago, lucky timing, CBS did a survey of 100 basketball coaches, top 100 basically, all anonymous, who are the cleanest coaches in college basketball. Number six was Tom Izzo. A very respectable six. That's a very good list to be on. The five in front of them, I know all to be clean. And number one is John Beilein of Michigan. So consider the fact for a second that Beilein's team lost to who? Rick Pitino in 2013. And now we know how he lost, basically. And now you've also got Tom Izzo has been to seven Final Fours, only won one of those Final Fours. You're almost always losing to one of the programs currently under investigation. So I hope the basketball fans, the state of Michigan, the Spartans and the Wolverines, start looking at those second place trophies a little more kindly.
You have been talking about this issue of paying student athletes. Is that the cure?
Not to me. I think what you have to have is and people are talking about that. I get why, because there's only one way to get there right now. It's college basketball or football, which is ridiculous. It's round peg, square holes. Doesn't always work. You need in basketball and football the same thing you've always had in hockey and baseball, and that is a viable minor league. These are the only two sports in the world that don't have a minor league system to lead you to the pros. Basketball and football in America, that's it.
Michigan Radio sports commentator, John U. Bacon. Thanks, John.
Thank you.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Last Friday, Education Secretary Betsy DeVos replaced Obama-era guidance on campus sexual assault with an interim rule that she says gives greater consideration to the due process rights of the accused. She called on schools to confront sexual assault and behaviors head-on while keeping the process fair and impartial, giving everyone more confidence in its outcomes. On Wednesday's Stateside, we spoke with civil rights attorney Deborah Gordon. She has represented men accused of campus sexual assault. Today, we welcome two guests with a different view on campus sexual assault, Miriam Gleckman-Kroot and Nicole Bedera. They are PhD candidates in sociology at the University of Michigan, and they're campus sexual violence researchers. Welcome.
Great to be here. Thank you for having us.
So this month, you co-authored an opinion piece in the New York Times that asked the question, who gets to define campus rape? So what was your message in this piece, Nicole?
One of the things that really struck us about the conversation we were having around Betsy DeVos and all these decisions was that when she was talking about rape, she seemed to be talking about something very different than what we do in our work as researchers, in my previous role as a victim advocate. Miriam used to be an RA on a college campus. And so we're very much involved with survivors, the people who are experiencing sexual violence themselves. By the way she was talking about sexual violence, it seemed she didn't think a lot of the things that women experience as sexual assault counted as sexual assault. And that was one of the central things that we wanted to discuss in the piece.
What kinds of things? What are we talking about?
Like a sexual assault that occurs when a woman has had a lot to drink. This was sort of dismissed by somebody in her cabinet as a mistake, as a regrettable experience. The same thing with intimate partner violence, which can include sexual assault in the confines of a relationship. Then it was seen as, oh, these women are just angry that these relationships fell apart and that they've broken up. And we see those as legitimate reasons to file a Title IX complaint that should not be discouraged.
Now, this interim policy change that was just announced last Friday by Secretary DeVos, Miriam, what do you think the effect of this policy change will be?
A lot is still unknown, and part of the reason for that is DeVos is opening up a comment period. So she's allowing people to comment. What we do know so far is she released a Q&A alongside that guidance, and bulk of the decisions that she made within that Q&A reflect the needs of the accused and often come at the expense of the survivor's interests. So it looks as though she is interested primarily in protecting due process, and in our eyes, that it comes at the expense of survivors.
And the Obama policy that came out in 2011 in the now famous Dear Colleague letter, what do you feel that policy meant in this issue of campus sexual assault?
What the Obama administration really did was looked at what was happening on campus and saw that it was not working for survivors, that survivors were unwilling to report. They were often dropping out of college because of the trauma they were dealing with. And there were things that they needed to be able to complete their educations. So they crafted a bunch of policies that would make it easier for survivors to come forward and make it easier for them to get the things that they need. And these things are not necessarily about holding the accused responsible or punishing them. They're really simple. They're things like being able to take your final exam later, being able to have your assailant moved out of the dorm room next door to yours. They're much simpler than we make them sound like. And so that's what the Obama administration was really trying to do, was make this a system that was even possible for survivors to want to come forward to it so that they could complete their educations.
I want to get a sense of the problem of sexual assault on campus to characterize that. Let's start with Deborah Gordon's take on this. This is based on cases that she's been involved with.
I fail to see how it's a sexual assault problem as much as it is a problem of people getting drunk, not keeping their wits about them, and then trying to steer their way through who gave consent when, and did I say yes when I really meant no.
What's your take? How do you see the problem of sexual assault on campus?
Well, we know that a lot of sexual assaults on campus involve alcohol, but that does not mean that consent was given. In fact, alcohol is the most commonly used date rape drug. It's something that a lot of men would admit that they use to loosen up a woman, to change the decision she would make at the end of the night otherwise. We see that as coercive. We see that as not consensual. And so when you dismiss all of these charges as they're simply just about women drinking too much, it misses the way that alcohol is used as a date rape drug.
I do think it's not just women drinking too
much.
I think what I heard was both parties, and alcohol is certainly an issue, and it's both sides.
And that I almost find more upsetting because if we're insinuating that when men have had too much to drink, they're incapable of raping, that allows them to drink as a way to get away with sexual violence. And I find that deeply problematic.
Why is it that college campuses have tribunals for sexual misconduct accusations? I mean, why don't we just call the local police and send cases to the prosecutor and onto the court system?
Title IX is a federal civil rights law that secures non-discrimination on the basis of sex and gender in educational environments. Schools are required by law to protect students and promote equal access to education under Title IX. So sexual violence constitutes a violation of Title IX, and therefore schools have a responsibility to respond and adjudicate instances of sexual violence that occur on their campus. Importantly, this does not preclude the possibility that survivors can go seek recourse through the criminal justice system, but it does provide a mechanism through which they can secure education.
To get us all on the same page, I want to understand and have us all understand what the process is for handling complaints. So if I walk in and say to you as a survivor's advocate, all right, I've been raped, then what happens?
Well, I mean, there's an ideal version of what happens and then what actually happens. We know that the process that we're about to describe is not always what happens. But what should happen is that both the person who makes the complaint and the respondent to that complaint, so that'd be the person accused, they come in to do an interview. They have a chance to bring forward any evidence they think is relevant. And then a Title IX coordinator looks over everything.
A complainant can come forward with some evidence. Title IX coordinator and or somebody in her office will follow through on that complaint by reaching out to the accused student, receiving evidence from the accused student, including a statement if they want, as well as looking at text messages and photographs shared between the couple. And then the Title IX office collects all that evidence, brings it into a meeting, and adjudicates basically on whether the weight of the evidence is in one direction or another.
And does the man that I'm accusing get to question me?
It really depends on the school. So one of the things that people have been discussing is this idea of due process and whether or not people who are accused get to confront their accusers. And a lot of schools don't really fit into that model because they're using something called the single investigator model, which is what Michigan does, where there is no hearing. They're never putting these two people into the same room at the same time. It's kind of similar to what you would get in a case of academic dishonesty, that you don't have to bring the professor and the student into the same room if a student is accused of academic dishonesty. This is just another honor code violation. But at some schools, the ones who DeVos is speaking to more directly, they have something that we call a hearing model. And in those cases, it really depends on how the school handles things. But in most cases, there is some way for the person who is accused to ask questions to their accuser, but usually not directly. Because you can imagine if you have been raped by someone, you don't want to come in and see your rapist face to face, much less have them being able to ask whatever questions they want while people at your school just stand by and watch silently. That's incredibly traumatizing. And so instead, what a lot of schools have switched to is allowing people who've been accused to submit their questions in writing, and then they'll be asked by a third party. But they can still often be present for when that takes place.
How do you think due process for the accused has been handled in cases of schools investigating sexual assault? In your experience, how do you think that's been handled?
It's tough to say because there's not a ton of information on it. One thing that I've found really interesting that I'm going to be doing my dissertation on is trying to figure out what it is that the accused want. What are they thinking are their needs that are not being met? Is it that they don't want to be accused in the first place because they find that stressful? That's never something that their university can offer them. Or do they have specific complaints about the process along the way? We're part of a huge project at the University of Michigan studying how over 380 schools are handling Title IX on their campuses. And one of the things that we just looked at is how these schools, at least in policy documents, are adjudicating sexual misconduct. And we found a huge array of supportive resources or none for complainants or for respondents, for the people who've been accused. And so in some cases, they are explicitly allowed things like counseling, occasionally things like academic adjustments, the sorts of things that DeVos have been looking for. In other cases, it's just not included in their policy, but that doesn't mean that they haven't been offered counseling or they haven't been offered to bring someone along. I know at the University of Michigan in particular, people who are accused of sexual misconduct are encouraged to bring someone with them to their very first meeting on campus. So this idea that the accused are not allowed any rights seems rare. that that's happening on college campuses, to say the least.
You know, this week, just this week, the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals handed down a ruling in a case of John Doe v. University of Cincinnati and two individuals. And in essence, the appeals court said that given the he said, she said nature of the case, the failure to provide any form of cross-examination of the accuser made the proceeding fundamentally unfair. Can we do better?
I don't think anybody is saying that the Obama-era guidance was perfect. And I definitely think that there are instances in which we could have done better to secure the rights of the accused and the survivor. With that said, I think that this conversation, especially in the post-Obama era, in the era in which DeVos is leading the Department of Education, is largely recentered around what is truthfully a really small minority of cases in terms of, first of all, we know that the rates of false reporting are very low. Litzak and a series of his colleagues in 2010 did a study that found between 2 and 5% of reports of sexual violence are false. And by false, I mean given untruthfully. And we also know that of all the cases that are falsely reported to the university, very few of them actually end in a responsible finding. And so we really, in the case that you are bringing up, and I don't know the specifics of this case, but I will say it is a small number of cases. And a vast majority of cases, survivors bring their stories to the university in truthfulness and in needing of help. And I think that those are the people that we really need to make sure that this conversation ends up focusing on.
But if you are accused, and even though there aren't many, if your university career is torpedoed because you've been accused, as you say, even if it's a small number, that's huge. And it strikes me that, as you describe, Nicole, there's a real patchwork amongst the universities in this country. Why, you know, why don't we have more uniform standards for schools so everybody's kind of on the same field instead of this patchwork?
I wish you asked Betsy DeVos that question, because truthfully, I think that her recent guidance is going to just inspire tremendous confusion among colleges and universities by allowing campuses the option to choose between a preponderance of the evidence standard and a clear and convincing standard, by eliminating the time frame requirement through which universities have to complete their investigations and their findings. And all of these things are just going to increase confusion among campuses.
Beyond that, I think there's something to be said that there are parts of the process that could be made more clear from the Obama-era guidances, but they've now been entirely eliminated. So we're actually starting at square one all over again. The changes that have been put into place are not necessarily any more clear. There's a possibility that universities during the period for comments will make them more clear, but there's a huge array of what universities can offer their students based off of things like size, the size of their endowment, how many students they have. And so there needs to be some room for flexibility for the schools as well. One of the things that struck me when reading the Q&A from the DeVos administration was the way that everything is supposed to now be equal, that you can only offer survivors just as much as you can offer people who've been accused of rape. And I saw that as a way to limit the number of resources offered to survivors. And there are some resources offered to survivors that don't make sense to give to somebody who's been accused of rape because they don't have the same needs. They're not undergoing trauma in the same way. I guess I'm just not optimistic about the changes that DeVos is making to say that they actually will clarify the process. And I wish that we could go back in time and keep the Obama-era guidance and then modify some components of it to say things like, you need to offer counseling resources to people who've been accused of sexual assault.
One of the things that the legal system in this country provides us with is case law. And this, the Obama-era guidance was not in place long enough to provide case law where we're able to see where the patchwork in the system means that certain people are unfairly disadvantaged. But the fact that this guidance has now been revoked means that we do not have that opportunity to improve it.
That was Miriam Gleckman-Kroot and Nicole Bedera, PhD candidates in sociology at the University of Michigan, and they research campus sexual violence. Today's Stateside was directed by Allie Billings and engineered by Peg Watson. Our executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Mercedes Mejia, Mike Blank, Lindsay Scullin, Sarah Leeson, Danielle Pryor, and Tyler Scott. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so very much for listening.